You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Tokuingua, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your temporary host Kaden and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Rowan. Efai Akane coming up on the show. For our regular catch-up, I speak to the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March about Scrutiny Week and the high number of people leaving Aotearoa. I also speak to SAFE's Emma Brody about the government's delay on banning greyhound racing. Rowan, what have you got for us today?
I spoke with Dr. Laura Revelle from the University of Canterbury about a new international study showing the harmful impacts of old satellites on the ozone layer. I also spoke with Senior Human Rights Advisor Oliver Christella from the Human Rights Commission about the importance of including the ethnicity pay gap in the conversation.
For this week's Get Action, producer Otto speaks to Alex Johnston from Common Grace Aotearoa to talk about a petition of his calling for the government to end carbon offset subsidies to polluting industries. He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch to Kupatuhi Mai, text it on 5395, or Waia Mai Rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka awa e wareware e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō he pakehere rokiroki mārunga i te pai tukutuku o Irirangi Pohomi haere ki 95BFM erakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or call Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
This week is Scrutiny Week in Parliament. This is a chance for the opposition to question relevant ministers about the budget and select committees and for the public to see the inner workings of government questioned in an accessible way. Some of the headlines to have come out of this week include discussions of New Zealand failing to uphold our climate commitments, supporting media, and what makes this country livable in light of the high numbers of New Zealanders moving overseas. For our weekly catch-up with Green Party MP Ricardo Menendez-March, I ask about all of these topics. I start by asking about what Scrutiny Week means.
For the first time ever, we've introduced the ability for opposition to grill ministers throughout a single week, allowing for almost double the time to have ministers in front and officials, which means we'll have a much more in-depth scrutiny about the decisions that the government has made this year in relationship to the budget, whether it's to not fund cancer drugs, to cut employment services, and decisions they would have made around infrastructure as well. And in previous years, this process would have taken several months, and it also meant that the public didn't take it as an event, and it was harder for media to cover. So this was a cross-party approach to ensuring that the government could properly be held to account and that we increase public interest around it.
Yesterday during this process, you suggested to Communications Minister Paul Goldsmith that the government was taking a hands-off approach with media. Can you speak to this comment?
Media is, at the moment, at least in New Zealand, collapsing when it comes to particularly public media and community media outlets. One of the concerns that we had was that the minister seems to be taking a hands-off approach when it comes to things like emerging technologies, the role that AI, for example, plays in displacing jobs and sound technicians. And we're also concerned around the lack of reliable funding sources for public media, but also for community media as well. And I acknowledge the role that student media and community media run by ethnic communities place when it comes to ensuring that groups that perhaps don't consume traditional public media outlets get critical information. And we've seen how important that is when there are civil defense emergencies or public health crises that some of that critical information also gets out to communities.
Moving on to climate, can you talk a bit about what the budget means for our climate commitments?
Well, the government has once again decided to ignore all the evidence around climate change and poured billions of dollars into polluting infrastructure rather than investing in things like rail and other forms of public transport. We also know that the government continues to not hold polluters to account and continues to exempt some of our biggest polluters from paying their fair share to contribute to their emissions. This includes big agribusinesses and the forestry industry as well. Now, the reality is we need a government that takes climate change seriously, and if countries start ignoring the evidence and not doing their best to ensure that we can have a livable planet, we're going to potentially see massive species extinctions and billions of people facing displacement in decades to come.
One notable point on this is that the government is refusing to add agriculture to the emissions trading scheme. Is this concerning?
The government continues to give big agribusiness a free pass at the expense of farmers who actually will pay the consequences of climate change, and that will have flow-on effects in our ability to continue to produce food and to look after the land that we live in. The ETS is based on market solutions, and it's one of the few levers that we have at the moment to ensure that polluters are contributing their fair share. We have more to do on top of adding agriculture into the emissions trading scheme to support farmers who transitioned to far more regenerative methods of farming. And so the Greens have been calling for a long time to include agriculture into the emissions trading scheme, but also to have support packages for farmers to move to more sustainable forms of practice, so that we bring everyone along into the journey of taking climate change seriously and ensuring that future generations can have access to Kai and to a livable planet.
Is there some regret from the Greens for prioritising cross-partisan support over more substantial legislation with things like the Zero Carbon Bill, when everything is being unwound by this government anyways?
My position has always been that the real power does not necessarily lie in politicians agreeing with one another, but with the public and the grassroots movements moving the window to a place where it's untenable for politicians to not take climate change seriously. So I'm looking forward to continue building that power and working alongside people on the ground to ensure that we shift the public opinion on these issues, and that we create strong civic society movements that allow for politicians to never be able to botch in the same way that we've managed to create enduring changes when it comes to voting rights that you would never think now would be taken away. We need to continue building the same kind of public support, because ultimately it's not going to be politicians leading the way on this, and I think the Greens need to continue to hold that principle and all of everything that we do in our politics, and rely more on the power of the people rather than the power of politicians agreeing with one another.
Finally, it was revealed last week New Zealand is facing record high levels of migration out of the country. What needs to change to keep people here?
Well, I mean, I think the government is partly or largely responsible for this, right? We've got a government that has refused to introduce legislation that controls how much rent can go up by, and is not building enough public housing. And so you've got people who simply cannot afford to pay rent in Aotearoa, despite having pretty decent salaries. At the same time, we've got a government that is cutting thousands of jobs. And for many of those people that find themselves without a job, they're facing financial difficulties and their lives turn upside down. And some of them are having to make that incredibly hard decision of having to move overseas to be able to provide for themselves and their families. And so the Greens continue to call for stronger public service, for things like rent controls, better public transport, to ensure that we create the conditions where people want to stay. I can't blame people who have to make those incredible decisions to leave the country for a better life when they're seeing a government that does not take their livelihoods and their well-being seriously.
I can probably guess your answer to this, but do you think the budget will make New Zealand a more desirable place to live?
When we've got a government that continues relying on trickle-down economics and handouts to landlords to make housing more affordable, and continues thinking that cutting thousands of jobs is the answer to the problems that we face, I can't see a reason why many of the people who have now left to places like Australia would want to come back. We need a government that takes the climate crisis and inequality crisis seriously to create thriving communities where people feel like they can grow old in Aotearoa. And this is why we continue campaigning to not just lead the opposition, but to have a green-led government where we can actually create the conditions for people who have left to come back, but also people who have decided to stay to have a good life.
That was Green MP Ricardo Menendez-March on Scrutiny Week and the record numbers of people leaving New Zealand.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
What's his title? The guy in charge, Dr. Ashley Broom?
The Director General of Health.
Yeah.
The Wire.
A new international study has recently been published showing the potential harmful impacts of old satellites on the ozone layer. The study concluded that the increase of old satellites orbiting the Earth might seriously harm the recovery of the ozone layer. This morning, I spoke with Dr. Laura Revell from the School of Physics and Chemical Science at the University of Canterbury about this new research. I started off by asking what the state of the ozone is currently and how exactly these old satellites might impact its recovery. I then asked what we can expect in the short and long term and what precautions need to be taken to address these issues. So this new international research has proved the risks of old satellites jeopardizing the recovery of the ozone layer. Before we dive into the reasons this is happening, can you give us a brief overview of what the current damage to the ozone layer is?
Yeah, so the ozone layer began to be damaged quite severely late last century, around the 1980s and 1990s, from chlorofluorocarbons that were used in things like refrigeration and air conditioning, various industrial processes. Those chemicals are now, the CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, are now banned, but they have very long lifetimes. So there's heaps of them still up in the stratosphere where the ozone layer sits, and they cause an ozone hole to form over Antarctica every springtime. We have started to see some early indications that we might be seeing recovery of the ozone hole thanks to the Montreal Protocol, which is the mechanism by which CFCs were banned, but it's going to take several decades more before we see that full recovery in the absence of any other confounding processes acting to slow that recovery.
And can you go into more detail about how these old satellites are harming the ozone?
So first I should clarify, we don't actually know that they are going to harm the ozone layer. What this new paper has done has shown that when satellites are deorbited and burn up in the upper atmosphere, they burn up into tiny nanoparticles containing aluminium oxides. And the authors are saying that those could potentially cause ozone depletion, but no one's quantified yet how much ozone depletion we might expect to see. I guess the best analogy is, or similar cases, with some rocket launches which use a type of rocket fuel that contains alumina particles in it, and some studies have showed that when those particles are injected in the atmosphere, if there's some chlorine around, like from the breakdown of CFCs, then those two things can act in combination. The alumina and the chlorine can act to cause some ozone loss. But like I said, no one has actually quantified what the damage to the ozone layer could be from deorbiting mega constellations yet.
So we don't really know what the scale of this potential damage could be, both short-term or long-term?
Correct. We've just identified that there could potentially be a problem here, and now would be a great time to stop and think and assess whether we might be dealing with a large-scale problem before we launch heaps more satellites into space.
And building on that, moving forward, what precautions or actions need to be taken to minimise this potential harm?
So I think the operators that are launching satellites need to be very aware of potential environmental risks. And thinking about how they're designing their satellites, what materials they're using and how they break up, so doing that full life cycle assessment. I think governments should also be aware of the potential problems and if needed, you know, trying to create regulatory frameworks to ensure that we're, you know, protecting the health of the upper atmosphere for the benefit of everyone.
That was Dr. Laura Revell from the University of Canterbury about the potential harmful impacts of old satellites on the ozone layer.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beer.
Earth went silent, London fell asleep. She dreamed of a winter where you appeared to me. Perfect timing as new battles in November. A tender creature, a fever, disarming fluorescent. There you were, with your mirror, shining the world all over me. There I was, with my butterfly net, trying to catch your light. I collected stupid ashes, so that after you'd gone, I could hold on to something. But you stayed unwavering through every false goodbye, unsubsiding, pining for now and for never. There you were, with your mirror,
Not your regular night at the movies. The Vista Foundation 48 Hours Auckland City Finals is on. Sky City Theatre, Saturday, June 29th.
Strap in for a rollercoaster ride of laughter and thrills with 15 spectacular, bizarre and debatably genius short films made by local filmmakers in only 48 hours.
Plus, find out who will take out the Auckland City Awards.
The Vista Foundation 48 Hours Auckland City Finals. Sky City Theatre, Saturday, June 29th, 7 p.m. Tickets from eventfinder.co.nz. The early bird gets the worm, and the early 95 BFM listener gets a good spot at Bestie Cafe for 95 BFM's Breakfast Club in St. Kevin's Arcade, Friday, June 21 from 7 till 10 a.m.
Join the breakfast team at Bestie Cafe and help us say bon voyage to Rachel with a special live broadcast featuring music from Jim Nothing and CCTV, a live Hobby Goblins, second guessing and weather from the one and only Rick Breeze.
Breakfast Club with Rachel at Bestie Cafe from 7 till 10 a.m. Friday, June 21.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Yesterday, Minister for Racing Winston Peters told a select committee he would not rush a decision on whether or not greyhouse racing will be banned. He cited the potential legal ramifications of a ban and also made the comment that dogs love racing. I spoke to campaign manager for the animal rights group SAFE, Emma Brodier, about this delay in making a decision on a ban. I started by asking about SAFE's thoughts on Winston Peters' more controversial comments.
Yes, well, Winston Peters made comments in a select committee meeting and in the media that he will not rush his decision on the future of greyhound racing due to fears about potential legal risk. However, we're not sure what he means by this. He refused to clarify what he meant by this, and so we've sent a letter to the minister seeking clarification.
Why has it been such a slow process to ban greyhound racing, in your opinion?
It's been a really frustrating experience, to be honest. There have been 4 reviews into the industry over the past decade, which show that the significant animal welfare issues associated with greyhound racing remain unchanged. So the industry has had 10 years of chances to clean up their act. So I think it's just a lack of political will to take decisive action and finally ban greyhound racing.
Winston Peters says if there was animal cruelty, he'd address that. And he doesn't think there is animal cruelty in the industry or something to that effect. What would your response to those comments be?
Well, yeah, he said that he needs a clear picture before making his decision, but we believe that he has got all the evidence he needs. There are dogs who continue to suffer catastrophic welfare outcomes while this decision is pending. The previous government put the industry on notice for failing to improve animal welfare, and since that day there have been over 2,500 injuries, 276 fractures and 26 deaths. And 4 of those were just in the past month. So as long as greyhound racing remains legal, animals will continue to suffer and die. So if the minister is utterly opposed to animal cruelty, as he claims, he will make the right decision and ban greyhound racing to protect these gentle animals from any further harm.
Apart from New Zealand First, what have other political parties' official stances been?
Yeah, there is clear cross-party support for a ban on greyhound racing. The Greens have long called for a ban. Earlier this year, Labor announced their support of a ban, and even our own Prime Minister has expressed that he believes the industry needs to go in the final leaders' debate before the election. And that aligns with public sentiment as well. The public overwhelmingly supports a ban on greyhound racing. So it's really just Winston Peters and the small minority of people in society that profit from racing greyhounds that are standing in the way here.
My next question was going to be, does a ban on greyhound racing have public support? But if it does have public support, why do you think this hasn't influenced politicians to ban it yet?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because public support for a ban is overwhelming. SPCA ran a poll not too long ago which showed that 74% of Kiwis would vote to ban greyhound racing in a referendum, and over 38,000 people signed a petition in 2021. So it's clear, again, that there's just a lack of political will, because greyhound racing clearly doesn't align with the values and expectations of society.
If the Prime Minister does support a ban on greyhound racing, could he be doing more to sway Winston Peters to go ahead with a ban?
We'd really like him to. He sort of made that pre-election, not commitment, but intention that it didn't align with his personal views or perhaps that of his party. It wasn't very clear. He said that the decision does sit with Winston Peters as it is his portfolio. And so we'd just urge him to take heed of the public opinion and all of the evidence of harm in greyhound racing and make the right decision.
And what is being done by SAFE and other organisations at the moment to continue to put pressure on the government to support this ban?
Yeah, we continue to highlight the harm associated with greyhound racing. You know, every week there are multiple injuries, sometimes fractures and deaths. Sometimes we see banned substances being used by greyhound trainers. So those are things that we continue to highlight. And then last month, we published a joint commitment with other animal protection organisations, SPCA, HOOHA and Dog Watch, to assist with the rehoming of greyhounds in the event of industry closure to ensure that a smooth transition for the greyhounds is possible into permanent and loving homes. And Winston Peters earlier this week expressed concern about the potential for mass euthanasia of greyhounds if the industry were banned. And we're not sure what this is based on, considering this commitment from animal protection groups to assist with that.
And are there ways members of the public who support the ban can support what SAFE is doing in this space?
Absolutely. We'd really encourage people to contact Winston Peters and let him know how strongly you feel that greyhound racing needs to be banned, because he has indicated in the past that he will make a decision based on social license, although his comments earlier in the week didn't really indicate that. But if there's enough public pressure and public momentum towards the message that greyhound racing is inherently dangerous and harmful, that can help with adding that political pressure.
That was SAFE campaign manager Emma Brodier on Racing Minister Winston Peters' position on greyhound racing.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire. It's time to get action with Action Station Aotearoa, the segment where we chat with the people campaigning for a fairer future.
The largest pollution companies in Aotearoa are given subsidies of up to $600 million a year to offset their carbon emissions in the form of free carbon credits. The government says these subsidies are important for meeting its emissions mitigation targets without stifling economic growth. However, as Aotearoa continues to face the effects of the global climate crisis, many have called out the government's policy of subsidising carbon credits, saying that they give polluting industries a free pass to continue generating emissions. For this week's Get Action, Otto spoke to Alex Johnston from Common Grace Aotearoa to talk about a petition he started calling for the government to end subsidies for carbon credits. Here is that interview.
So to start things off, tell us a bit about the petition.
So today we delivered a petition signed by over 6,000 people calling on the Minister of Climate Change to end free carbon credits. And this is a petition that's aimed at stopping the subsidising of pollution by our government to large industry, where we have around $500 million a year that goes to directly subsidise the pollution of big heavy industries like steel, cement, fertiliser producers in the form of free carbon credits. And our petition was setting out a range of policies that called for how we can end free carbon credits and how we transition industry to help them decarbonise.
Tell us a bit about what free carbon credits are and how the government subsidises carbon offsets.
Yeah, so the idea of carbon credits exist as a part of our system of emissions pricing, where we set a price on pollution to incentivize us all collectively to reduce emissions in the best way possible. And so we, you know, individual households, we face an emissions price in our petrol costs or our household electricity costs that passed on to us from the retailers. And most of the economy is covered in some way by a carbon price. Yet there are a section of industries that don't pay the full cost of the carbon price, because they receive from the government these carbon credits for free, which they would otherwise have to purchase to pay for their pollution. And so there's certain industries that get these credits for free. 15 years ago, when this was set up, they were deemed to be exposed to unfair offshore competition. But the times have changed, the technology has shifted dramatically, and now we just have this ongoing subsidy to these industries. So rather than them having to purchase carbon credits from the government or from forestry producers to offset their pollution or to reduce their pollution so that they don't face that cost, instead, they don't have to do anything for the vast bulk of their climate footprint because they get those for free from the government. That's been on a very slow phase out over the last few years, but it's such a slow phase out that what it means is that in 2050, when the whole country is meant to be at net zero, we'll still be subsidizing these industries to pollute with free carbon credits. They'll still be getting at least 30% of their pollution covered by free carbon credits in 2050, which is just crazy. So yeah, that's why we think it's time to change that system and reform the emissions trading scheme so that we're no longer giving out these free carbon credits for free.
So what kind of industries are receiving free carbon credits?
So the vast bulk of carbon credits are given to just five companies, actually. So in New Zealand, we don't have a large diversity of heavy industry players. So we have New Zealand Steel is one of the biggest recipients, so the steel producer, the aluminium smelter, TY Point, Fletcher Concrete, producer of concrete, Methanex, which produces methanol, and Balance Agri-Nutrients, which produces synthetic fertilizer. So those five companies together, they get around 3/4 of all the free carbon credits, but their pollution footprint is actually just five companies is really massive. So they have the same pollution footprint as around 2 million petrol cars, just those five factories. And so These industries, which when the emissions trading scheme was set up, the theory was that they didn't have easy options to decarbonize. But that was 15 years ago. Times have changed. And we saw last year with the deal that New Zealand Steel did with the government, where they did have an option to decarbonize. But under the status quo, they're not going to take those sorts of initiatives by themselves when they're getting a subsidy to keep going with their current production process. So it's those heavy industries where it might have been a barrier to decarbonizing, but there isn't anymore for many of them.
So essentially, our government is giving subsidies to a small handful of companies without really giving them any incentives to actually lower their emissions.
That's right, yeah. And this current government has said that they don't like subsidies. They don't want to subsidize businesses. They think businesses should stand on their own two feet. But that's actually what's happening with these free carbon credits. What we really should be doing is making them pay the full price of carbon, but also supporting them to decarbonize. You know, strategically, if it's important for New Zealand to have a domestic steel producer, we don't want New Zealand Steel to shut down and go offshore, then there is a role for government to play in supporting them. But that support should come in the form of helping them decarbonize, not maintain business as usual. And so the current government wants to rely really heavily on emissions pricing to meet their climate targets. But this is one major barrier to the emissions trading scheme doing its job, which is pricing pollution, when these big, heavy industries don't face that price.
Do you think that these industries are actually profiting directly from the carbon subsidies?
Yeah, there's no doubt that the financial value of the free carbon credits is really massive. And these industries have come to kind of expect it as an entitlement rather than see it as a transitional measure. Some of the industries have made the argument that they need these free carbon credits to fund their decarbonisation initiatives, but there's no real proof that that's where they're putting the money from free carbon credits into. Also, that argument also relies on the idea that they would, rather than using their credits they get from the government to actually meet their own liability of their emissions footprint, they're selling them back on the market to generate a profit, which they then supposedly use to fund decarbonisation initiatives. So that whole way of funding decarbonisation is just really inefficient. It's not the best way to do that. The best way to do that is you say, you want to decarbonise, here, we'll help you do that. But we want to see that, you know, there's a direct follow through, like the government did last year with New Zealand Steel, which was a good example of that, rather than simply giving them free credits and trusting that they'll do the right thing with that.
How are individuals and households impacted when polluting industries continue to generate emissions?
Yeah, so currently households are doing it tough. You know, the cost of living has gone up a lot, and it's important that we all take responsibility for our climate footprint and do face a price on our pollution. But we already do that at our household electricity bills, at the petrol pump. And so when we're playing our part, it actually puts more of the burden on individuals and on households when these industries are not playing theirs. And so collectively, our economy is trying to meet certain targets under a shrinking kind of allowable budget of pollution that we weren't allowed to put out. And when these industries are not playing their share of that burden, then that puts an outsized share on households. not to say households shouldn't be doing their bit, but we're having to carry the load when these big industries, which are by and large multinational corporations with billion-dollar budgets, that they are not actually doing their bit.
The petition calls for the government to provide loans for decarbonisation options as an alternative for carbon offsets. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we recognise that if we remove free carbon credits without providing the right structures and supports in place for industry, that could lead to, you know, the shutdown of a large factory which employs a lot of people in communities. And we don't want that to happen ideally. And if it did, we want it to happen in a managed and supported way. So where there are decarbonisation options, it might be that an industry needs finance to help bring that forward, make that an option, like we saw with the New Zealand Steel deal. However, we don't think that should be cash in hand with no strings attached. We think it should be in the form of a loan or in return for some sort of equity stake in that company if they're going to receive a large subsidy to decarbonize. So the New Zealand Steel deal, where they received around $120 million to decarbonize one of their furnaces, which has a really big impact, is a really good thing for them to do. We think in that case, it probably should have been in the form of a loan rather than a grant with no strings attached.
The petitions received quite a large number of signatures, and recent protests like the March for Nature, which had a large turnout, show there's clearly a large number of people in Aotearoa who want the government to do more to protect the environment. How confident are you that the government will listen to the opposition and make that shift in its policies?
It's important that people maintain the pressure for that to happen. And, you know, certainly people are making their voices heard, as well as through this petition, which is really encouraging to see. I think it's in our advantage that the government needs to meet their emissions targets, and they want to do that through relying heavily on the emissions trading scheme. And we're trying to provide them some constructive solutions that they can pick up and run with, that this shouldn't be a left and right issue. It should be something across the political spectrum. We need politicians to tackle this issue where we have this long-standing subsidy to pollute that can't remain in place, and it needs a complex set of solutions to deal with it. And that requires working across the spectrum to make that happen, so that we don't have a flip-flop between governments and then we don't get actually any action in this area. So I think the set of solutions we're offering is something that the government could pick up and run with, but we do need people to continue to make their voice heard. And there's an opportunity to do that coming up when the government consults on its next climate plan for the next 5 years. This is called the Emissions Reduction Plan, and they're due to release it imminently with a public consultation. And so we'll be encouraging people to submit to call for an end to free carbon credits in that submission process. And if lots of people make their voices heard, then we can help that to climb up the priority list so that the government does follow through on this.
We're now at the end of the interview. Do you have any closing statements you'd like to finish off with?
I think just to say that I think it would be obvious to everyone that subsidizing pollution during a climate crisis doesn't make sense. And there are solutions out there that we can follow the example of, like the European Union has tackled this problem by ending their free carbon credits and introducing a phase out and bringing in other measures that can support the industries to decarbonize. So we don't have to do this kind of running blind and not with no sense of where we're going. There's examples out there of what's been done, and we need to follow that. Otherwise, we'll get left far behind.
And that was Alex Johnston from Common Grace Aotearoa talking to us about a petition to the government to end free carbon credits. If you're interested in signing this petition, you can find it on our.actionstation.org.nz under the name Don't Subsidise Pollution, End Free Carbon Credits. We will also attach the link to the podcasted version of this segment.
That was Get Action with Action Station Aotearoa.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
We'll be right back after the short break. Keep it on the beat. This is Macy's Night Out featuring Molly Payton.
Overthinking. Driving to the beach to wash my hair. It's a hopeless city. Likes to hold my hand when no one's there. I don't doubt that he was just a friend you knew from school. But friends don't kiss each other. Last night we had to choose. Is it just me or me and you? Story like the movies, not just another.
To remember her. Look, her first steps.
Aww.
Eating her first bird.
Ew.
And her last moment. I call this one raspberry jelly.
Ugh, why? What?
Damn that car.
What is that shining in the gutter?
Her beautiful angelic eye.
Pro Gear Photographic. For photos that'll bring out the light in your eyes, no matter the circumstance. Head to Pro Gear for all your photography needs. Open now at 3 Railway Street, Newmarket, or go to progear.co.nz.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out! He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's the beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A three-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
Lime Cordial are all juiced up and ready to perform this October at the Auckland Town Hall. And B-Card family, we're giving away tickets. So stay tuned to BFM all this week for your cue to enter. Have I ever once treated you bad or nasty? Lime Cordial, live at the Auckland Town Hall, October 20. Tickets on sale now from frontiertouring.com.
There is a boy I know.
wanted the attention.
That we need to convince this is a real fucking thing. Real friggin' thing.
The Wire.
The current coalition government has decided not to implement Labour's plan to do mandatory reporting for pay gaps with companies that have more than 250 employees. Instead, they will introduce a voluntary tool for companies to use in order to determine gender pay gaps. This morning, I spoke with Senior Human Rights Advisor Oliver Christella from the Human Rights Commission about what this tool is and how the benefits could be, what the benefits could be. We also discussed the Commissioner's call to include ethnicity pay gap into the conversation. We discussed the current state of the ethnicity pay gap and why there needs to be an increased focus on how on this now more than ever. Can you give us an overview of the new tool the government is using to help keep track of pay gaps?
Yeah, well, first, what I would say is it is good to see that the government has taken some action in this space. It's been a long time that we've been talking about pay gaps for working people. It's a small step, but it's a step in the right direction. What the government has done is it's developed a voluntary calculation tool to help reduce gender gaps. It's a focus on gender gaps. And the government has also said it will work with business leaders on an approach to pay gap reporting, but also how it will support other organisations understand, share and take action with the data. Personally, I'm quite interested in seeing what sort of support for businesses and taking action and measuring, because we know that measuring is the first step, but we need businesses to take action to look at how they can close the gap and look at their individual circumstances. I'd also add that we currently do have voluntary tools available. Mind the Gap run a voluntary tool, which not only has gender reporting and ethnic reporting as well, but hopefully by having the government get behind an initiative of having voluntary reporting, we will see businesses come out and take more leadership, more participation and drive more productive workforce.
And how does this tool compare to Labour's mandatory reporting plan for companies with over 250 employees?
Well, the big difference is the voluntary versus the mandatory. So the previous government announced that it would introduce mandatory gender reporting for larger businesses. They also said that they would move over time to reduce that businesses with only 100 staff. So they were looking at picking up a sizable part of the workforce and having mandatory reporting. And one thing I would say is when we're talking about pay gap reporting is this isn't a hugely onerous issue. There's tools and really it only requires employers to put in the data and have the information come out. So when we're talking about mandatory reporting or voluntary reporting, we're not talking about a big onus that's put on businesses to have an additional job. The other thing I would note about Labor's proposal is it was suggesting that they would move to mandatory ethnic pay gap in reporting in the future. I think they'd use terms like we're looking at including ethnic pay gap reporting in the future. And as you may well be aware, ethnic pay gaps are a significant part of the pay gap question and need to be addressed.
And building on that, as you said, the pay gap has been identified as an issue in Aotearoa. However, the Equal Employment Commissioner has said that this is not limited to the gender pay gap, but the ethnicity pay gap as well. Can you tell us what the ethnicity pay gap currently looks like in Aotearoa and how serious it is?
The ethnic pay gap is a really serious issue in Aotearoa. In 2022, the Commission Te Kahui Tika Tangata released a report into the Pacific Pay Gap Inquiry. Now, what we did is we looked at Pacific workers as the lowest paid ethnic pay group, and this was a conduit for us to look at all pay gaps. And the Commission's inquiry found that for every $1 that a Pākehā man earned, a Pākehā woman will be earning 89 cents, an Asian man and a Māori man will be earning 86 cents, an Asian woman would be receiving 83 cents, and a Pacific man and a Māori woman would be earning 81 cents, and Pacific woman were at the bottom earning only 75 cents of what a Pākehā man earned. So that we know while gender pay gaps are a problem in our country, we're not going to find equity in this space simply by addressing gender alone. We need to look broader and include ethnic pay gap reporting. The other thing I want to add around the Pacific pay gap is that it was very clear, and the research we did showed that it wasn't simply a matter of career choice or education or other factors. Over half of the Pacific pay gap was termed as unexplained. That means these factors couldn't explain the gap, and that discrimination was likely a factor in the pay gap. So we need to have these tools to identify these issues so that we can put in place better employment policies and reduce discrimination. I mean, at this rate, the Pacific pay gap was going to take 110 years to close. What that meant for a Pacific woman in reality is that over a working lifetime, we calculated that that gap would amount to over $488,000. And this is money to build a home, to start a business, to retire in comfort and dignity, or to look after your tamariki. And this is happening to whole communities. It's contributing to poverty. It means that when you go to the supermarket, you're not able to buy everything you need. So what we really need to do is ensure that we're looking at the whole problem, not just a small part of the problem, and we're not leaving any communities behind. What I would say to employers out there who are interested in progressing ethnic pay gaps is that there's some really good advice by organisation UpTempo, just released a tool called the Good Employer Matrix tool, which has some really good information and support for employers who are wanting to progress work in ethnic pay gaps, particularly with a focus on Māori and Pacifica staff. So I really encourage people to look at that. I think it's some good employer matrix. If you put that into Google, you'll get it.
And would you say that there is a strong connection between the ethnicity and the gender pay gap?
As you can see, the issue is intersectional. That means that, yes, what we saw very clearly is that Pākehā women are earning less, and that as we go through the ethnic group, we're seeing that women are generally earning less than men within their ethnic group. But we're also seeing that among men, they're lower paid. So I don't know if I would say there's a correlation between the two, but they're both issues that need addressing. They both need to be measured so that we can address them, and employers need to look at their own specific data and come up and look at the tools that exist to address all these gaps.
Do you believe this new tool could help create more transparency with the ethnicity pay gap as well, or is it more focused on the gender pay gap?
The current tool appears to be only focused on the gender pay gap. So the government has said that they will only be addressing gender pay gaps with a voluntary tool. But it's not too late for the government to add ethnic reporting. As I said before, it's not a complex matter to add that reporting, and it could easily be done, and these tools already exist. So what I would say to the government is it's great to see that we've had a first step where we're going to have a gender pay gap tool for voluntary reporting, but we need to add ethnicity as a first step. The other thing I would say is I just would like to see our government to be a little bit more bold, look at introduce mandatory gender and ethnic pay gapping reporting. And earlier this year, in April this year, New Zealand went to have its periodic review at the United Nations. That's a process by which different countries can make recommendations and look at New Zealand's human rights record. And one of the big themes was that New Zealand need to come out with mandatory pay gap reporting, and many countries said that this needs to happen for both ethnicity and gender. The other thing I would say is we're hearing from many businesses who are doing this already that it is good for business to have this reporting, to put in place this tool, that they're having higher productivity, better engaged staff. And I'm sitting here in Auckland today, and this is a diverse country, and we need to support all our diversity and all our employment to protect human rights and to advance our businesses.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just to say that businesses who are interested should be looking at the tools that are available. There's a lot of great work that already exists in this space. That as Aotearoa, we have a proud history of standing up for marginalised people, and addressing ethnic pay gaps is a really good way to do that.
That was Oliver Christella from the Human Rights Commission talking about the importance of including the ethnic pay gap in the conversation.
I don't know how to say this. Betelgeuse star?
You're not a child of the 80s. If you were, you would know the film with a similar name. The star is Betelgeuse.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Green Party MP Ricardo Menendez-March, Safe Campaigns Manager Emma Brodia, Alex Johnston from Common Grace Aotearoa, University of Canterbury's Dr. Laura Revell, and the Human Rights Commission's Oliver Christella. Neida hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.